Network, proudly presents The Jay's Blade Show. With your host, CyberGolf.com's own Jay Clemmer, and co-starring a galaxy of the golf and sports world's greatest names as a special guest. Yo, 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 this is your main man, DJ Q, telling you to put your hands together for your friend and mine, Jay Clemmer.
Thank you very much, DJ Q. He is absolutely right, everyone. You're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. I am Jay Flemmer, and welcome to our Holiday Spectacular Show. We've got an extra long show for you here. All of us at GNN and at Jay's Plays and Walk in the Park are so glad to have you aboard. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, or any other holiday that you celebrate. Jay's Plays is brought to you by JB's Best Hot Sauce. It's the best, the boldest, the spiciest hot sauce out there. It's on every table in the South, and it should be on yours, too. When it says JB's, it's the best. Guys, we have a terrific idea for your Christmas list. You've got just enough time to get it. We have brought back, once again, two of our very favorite people. They are great friends of golf, capital G, capital F, and capital G. Of course, we're talking about Tom Doak and Rand Morissette, Tom being the great golf course architect, one of the very best in the history of the game, and Rand Morissette, who is the owner and operator of Golf Club Atlas, but also is a key individual in Cabot Links and Cabot Cliffs, two courses that have been skyrocketing up everybody's rankings. It's a run, don't walk kind of place to go see, so it's a definite destination. Rand and Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jeff.
Glad to be here.
So, we've brought you back on also to talk about best idea for a Christmas gift for any ardent golfer, and that is Volume 3 of the Confidential Guide to Golf Courses is now out. Folks, you'll remember that Volume 1 was the UK and England and various courses in Europe, and Volume 2 was the summer destinations in the United States. Now Volume 3, which was out in October, is the northern destinations in the United States. And it's making a splash among the golf cognoscenti. So why don't you take a minute, Tom, to brief all of our listeners who might not be familiar with the Confidential Guide about what it is and give us a little bit of the history of the guide, bringing us up to the present.
Well, the book started just as a write-up for my friends of all the golf courses that I'd seen traveling around trying to learn about architecture and my honest reviews. The first book was only 40 copies and given to people in the golf business and people that had let me sleep on their couch when I was in Chicago for 4 days trying to teach them good. They showed it to their friends, and it turned out there was a lot of demand for something like that, especially something that was really honest and tried to grade courses on a 1 to 10 scale for how far out of your way you should go to see these places. So eventually, I published The Real Thing in the 90s, and it quickly became sought after and kind of a collector's item after it was out of print, because once I got better known as an architect, I figured it was best to keep it out of print instead of keeping reviewing golf courses designed by people that I competed with for jobs. So I didn't really know, I always figured I'd get back to the book someday, but I didn't know when. And now that things have slowed down and now that everybody knows for better or worse that it's controversial, but it's taken as face value that these are my honest opinions and I'm not trying to get work out of it. I felt the time was right to get back to the book. The one difference is, in order to try to cover as much of the world as I possibly could, I enlisted three friends to help me write the reviews and cover some courses that I hadn't seen myself. And Rand is part of that tribe. Rand and Darius Oliver from Australia and our friend Masan Ishijima from Japan. We're all similar in our tastes of golf courses, which was important. If it didn't make sense, it wouldn't have made sense to have co-authors who just had a completely different view than I did. But, you know, we're all pretty close to the same opinion on golf courses, never quite the same. But so you get a little more variety of opinion in this book. And, you know, by the time we're done with five volumes, we'll have covered about 2,500 golf courses around the world.
Now, when you say similar in taste and opinion, what I think, if you read between the lines, what we're really talking about is people that can distinguish the difference between a truly great golf course and a merely pretty good one. You know, we split hairs, apparently, in the confidential guide among the very best courses. You know, you once wrote in the first volume that an average course is a 3, so it gives you plenty of room at the top end to be able to fine-tune among the very greats. Rand, tell us a little bit about what are the general broad themes of what makes a course truly great as opposed to merely pretty good.
Well, to me, the easiest thing to do is to first think about the naked property before a golf course was built on it. What was the raw potential? Was it built on sandy soil, for instance? Is there good movement in the land? And it doesn't have to be as magnificent as Eastward Ho, but you know, Garden City can work if it's on sandy soil. Garden City on clay soil would be a different matter. And then you look at things like around the perimeter of the course. I mean, are you alone in nature? You know, have you escaped from your worries of the day, or are you always looking at homes? If it's a residential course, none of us are quite as moved as if it's core golf. And so, you know, then, you know, you go from there. It doesn't really matter whether it's private, public, or a resort. What matters to us is how much do you want to go back and play it. And if it's a very linear golf course demanding, you know, very straight drives and then, you know, very similar approach shots time and time again, that's not going to hold our interest. If you have to play far left to the outside of a dog leg because it happens to open up to where the day's hole location is and it gets your mind working, then, you know, we all find ourselves much more engaged in the proposition and tend to vote the courses that much higher. And a lot of times that comes down to how good are the green complexes at the end of the day. I mean, that's the target, and how good are they? And that goes a long way to defining ultimately a course's worth.
Sure, when people ask me the same question, I tell them that at least 2/3 of what I'm looking at is the design of the golf course, and that the natural setting itself, while it can help, is really only around 20%. And my favorite story about that is the time I was asked to go out and see Liberty National with a pal of mine who was a PR person for the golf course. And, you know, I'm walking across fairways to see how wide they are. I'm pacing across the greens. I took a divot to take a look at the turf and the net, see that it was clay soil, not sandy soil. And he looks at me, he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm looking at the very thing I was supposed to look at." He starts jumping up and down like a cartoon character with his hands on his head, and he points at the Statue of Liberty and starts yelling at me over and over again, "Just look at the statue, Jay, just look at the statue." But, you know, I tell all of my friends that story because that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for the bones of the golf course. We're looking for the angles, width of the fairways and movement in the earth, both vertical and horizontal, you know, to create interesting angles and options. So let's get right to some of the meat and potatoes. Why don't each of you take turns telling me about 3 new places that weren't in the first version of the guide that now are, that really, you know, jumped up and grabbed you and you really loved?
Okay. Well, Chuck. And funnily enough, I was chuckling to myself because both Rand and I and our contributors avoided Liberty National and didn't include it in the book at all.
Well, there you go.
Sometimes I'd rather just not see a course than go see something that I suspect I wouldn't like and have to write about it.
I invited a pal of mine to come play Bayonne with me one time, and he accidentally showed up at Liberty National. He was waiting for me before he could get out. He was at the wrong course. I asked him, what'd you think of it? He goes, well, the sandwich they gave me was good. All right, so three plates.
Well, the neat thing about the book, and one of the reasons I got back into it, is because it got me to go to some corners of America that I had never managed to get to, and seek out some courses there. So, last summer I went to Maine and New Hampshire. I saw a course in New Hampshire called Bald Peak Colony Club, a really private kind of summer club. Built by Donald Ross overlooking Lake Winnipesaukee. And, just beautiful place. You know, not a very long golf course. That's probably why it doesn't show up in any of the top 100 lists at all. I think it was only 6,300 yards long, and they'd never thought to put in any back tees. Not a lot of bunkers. There were a lot of greens that just kind of had a crowned front and, steep sides, so you're kind of play into the end of the deck of an aircraft carrier, and everything just fell away on all sides. Really hard to hit second shots that held the greens, and in a really beautiful place overlooking the lake.
It almost sounded a little bit like some of the Charles Banks courses that I've played, where you've got an aircraft carrier standing out there in the middle of the fairway, and you're trying to hit that.
Smaller aircraft carrier.
Now, you also said in one of your books, I think it was The Anatomy of a Golf Course, it's not how many bunkers you have, it's how interestingly placed they are.
That's right. I mean, when I'm designing a golf course myself, I don't really understand the idea of just surrounding a green with bunkers. I mean, that doesn't create any decisions on the part of the player. If you do that, you basically tell everybody, well, just hit it at the middle of the green or hit it right at the hole, because anything else is trouble. So I tend to favor a golf course that loads up the hazards on one side and gives you a safe play on the other. And that, the average player needs a safe play every once in a while. And the good player kind of foils themselves by taking it even if they don't need it, Instead of just aiming right at the hole and making birdies like the great players do, they tend to hedge when there's a place to hedge. So they hit a good shot and they still left themselves a 15-foot putt instead of a 5-footer right by the hole.
Or if they missed the second shot coming out of a bunker 7 feet deep. Exactly. Tacking your way around the golf course. That's the wonderful nature of strategic golf.
Exactly.
So Bald Peak Colony, how about a couple more?
Well, I went across Iowa last spring, which is kind of a cold trip. It didn't get above 50 degrees in April. But I saw a bunch of good golf courses there. The one that I should probably mention first to your readers or your listeners is a place called The Harvester, about a half an hour outside Des Moines. The Keith Foster course, and probably the best course he designed on his own. A high-end public course that's not getting a lot of play because it's a little far outside of Des Moines for that. So they're trying to get more people to come from out of state, and they built some cabins there to house them if they do. But a terrific big-scale golf course across open farmland and around a big, I think it was like a 40 or 50-acre lake. It was part of the farm operation before they built the golf course. A lot of variety to it, and Iowa was a windy place. So you're 1,000 miles from the ocean, but you still get some of the same hazards as playing seaside golf.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I've heard nothing but good things about Harvester for many years, actually. It's sort of become the public course in Iowa, but even in a much larger circle than that within the Midwest. And yes, Keith Foster's a rising star. I saw some very good work of his at River Bend in Maryland.
Yeah, and, you know, he's sort of seen the handwriting on the wall for the golf business, so instead of trying to compete for new work, he's doing nearly all renovation and restoration work these days, and has done some terrific stuff on that front, too, everything from Five Farms and the Baltimore Country Club to I know he's done a lot of work.
Philly Cricket Club, the Wissahickon course, and I think might have been the one you were reaching for, that was just masterful and absolutely faithful recreation of what Tillinghast might have done had they had the money and time to let him finish. Ran, your thoughts on Wissahickon?
I haven't seen that one. I've seen his work at Moraine, which I'm an enormous fan of, and Orchard Lake, and he's been in Southern Hills for a long, long time. And you just, you know, the nice thing about Keith is you never know that he was there. He rotates, like at Eastward Ho, you know, it still looks like a Fowler course versus the Allison course at Orchard Lake versus the Nipper Campbell at Moraine. I mean, they, you know, it's not the same. He doesn't do the same work impaled on each and every project like some other folks have in the past. He lets each course have its own flavor, which is nice.
Yeah, not like I said about another architect in the First Confidential Guide, but I never realized how much Ross and Tillinghast and McKenzie's styles were the same until I've seen this guy just restore all three of them.
Oh, snap. Ron, why don't you give us a couple of places that jumped up to you that you hadn't seen before that might not have been in the first volume, but that you said, yes, these are really, really terrific places.
Well, I'm a big fan of 62, 63, 6400-yard courses, and I don't believe, Tom, that Eastward Ho was in the first volume, and so that was nice to see it get its due. And a course like St. George's on Long Island, which is in a very tough neighborhood, it's just a wonderful, wonderful course, as you know, Jay. And so it's neat to pay tribute to that, just like we had done with Roaring Gap. We did with Roaring Gap as well in the North Carolina mountains. One of the nice things, Jay, about being involved with the book is Tom and I have taken a couple of trips together. And, you know, I very much enjoyed touring the Pacific Northwest with him. And we got to compare and contrast Gamble Sands and Chambers Bay with each other. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's a delight to share opinions with somebody like Tom. You know, and you look at the, you know, both courses on the surface, you could say are similar in that they have 50, 60, 70-yard wide fairways and big greens, but Chambers Bay has a lot more contour, you know, within the greens. But Gamble Sands has its own redeeming quality. So it's just really interesting, you know, getting to compare those on the same trip with Tom. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you know, so much of what everybody talks about these days are big, wide fairways with big greens, lots of angles, yada, yada, yada. So it's always fun to go back to kind of the opposite of that, which I think is the country club outside of Boston with, you know, 3,000-some square foot greens, and they don't have the chipping areas around the greens, and it's thick rough, and it's just old-fashioned golf, and it doesn't, they're not trying to follow today's trends, and so it has its own voice, which, you know, I really appreciate.
Well, you've mentioned a bunch of really fantastic places in there. Let's start with St. George's. I'm an enormous fan of Devereaux Emmett's work. Ever since I got a chance to see Garden City, yes, I know that there's a significant amount of Walter Travis there, too. I fell instantly in love with the Rockaway Hunt Club, the mix of Devereaux Emmett and A.W. Tillinghast. While I have you both on, am I right in thinking that that's the only time that Telling has ever designed on any sort of coast, the only, you know, waterway type of golf course that he ever designed on?
Well, Sand Point.
I don't recall Sands Point bordering the water anywhere near as much as that stretch of holes, that middle stretch of holes, sort of like 7 or 8 through 13 at Rockaway.
Well, I guess Tilling has evolved the Country Club of Fairfield after Rainer's routing. But, I mean, that's an interesting point. He did so much in the clay and rock around New York City.
I've always wondered that. Yeah, Tom?
Yeah, for that matter, Donald Ross only had like one or two chances to do it either out of 400 golf courses, other than Seminole, and I guess one hole at Gulfstream. I can't really think of anywhere that he worked along the ocean either. So, you know, I kind of pinch myself sometimes that I've done it so often because a lot of great designers have never had a chance.
You know, but the great thing about the very... the great thing about the very best designers, though, is that they could take a completely flat, boring, 1 foot of elevation change to Tomato Field and build a truly great golf course there.
Not often.
There were a few. Charles Banks and Rainer could do it. Well, you were going to say.
No, it just, you know, living as I do in central North Carolina, I've always been puzzled by why Donald Ross didn't do more in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, in the rolling sand dunes, you know, before the EPA and everything else. And it's just simply a matter of transportation. I mean, there's no train line out there. The automobile had yet to take hold when Ross started out. And in Tom's case, you know, you're not building in Tasmania without commercial jets and private planes and everything else. So it's really interesting to track the bigger, how golf architecture fits within the bigger picture.
Yeah, and you know, unfortunately, there are great sand dunes 30 miles from my house in Michigan, but they won't let me build anything in that.
Now, Rand, another thing I'd like to look into is you were talking about Boston. As I read golfclubatlas.com, which everybody should, while you're listening to this, go grab your computer and, you know, look over at the page. And, Rand, I haven't seen a course review from you on a course that I fell in love with this summer, absolutely loved, actually this fall, called Boston Golf Club, another of Gil Hance's work, this time an original design. Gil did the restoration at Rockaway Hunt Club, like Keith Foster's phenomenal restorations. But Boston Golf Club was called by no less a person than Tom Paul as the best course built since 1960. And I'm of the opinion that I'm wondering if it really isn't a 21st century rejoinder to Pine Valley. What are your thoughts and Tom's thoughts on Boston Golf Club?
Well, there's a lot of fine work there, but it'd be disingenuous not to admit that there's a 300-400-yard walk from the ninth green up to the 10th hole with a main road through that bisects the property. So, mm-hmm. You know, Corin Crenshaw passed on the opportunity for a reason.
Okay.
You know, but I mean, it's a very interesting course to study. What's the little short par four that's up the hill? Is that the fourth hole?
Number 5, Shipwreck. I was just writing about that one this afternoon. A pint-sized terror that will sink your scorecard. 300 yards straight up a hill with a green that's just a little sliver of a rectangle.
So in my opinion, Jay, I'll tell you, that green needs to be wider. A hole of that length, you want to tempt the golfer to drive the green. And when it's that much of a sliver, and given how firm they can keep that golf course, that's just a true hit and hope shot. I don't see where the real reward is in even attempting the shot. So that's an example of a hole that I know has legions of fans, but I would like to see it wider, the green wider to make.
Is it possible that it works though, Rand? Because and you could be absolutely right in that it should be wider or turned sideways. But is it all possible that because it is long and thin, that it's fair? Because if your driver runs out of it, it'll stay on the green. It gave you a little bit of room in terms of distance, where it took it away in accuracy.
Well, I would never hit driver there. I mean, there's just no, but there's no reason to, no percentage. The ball is never going to stay on. I don't know whether the at the narrow point it's 5 paces across, 8 paces across. You know, your driver is not going to stay there. So you're always going to hit, you know, a hybrid and a wedge. And to me, the most interesting short holes are going to goad you into decisions that you later regret. And to me, that hole, that green is severe enough to where it's going to goad you into playing smart golf, defensive golf, you know, play out to the left and then wedge on. And
also, in your favor on this side of the argument, a short hitter like me has to try to hit driver, otherwise we're not going to be able to crest that hill and it's going to come rolling down back at us. So you've got a point there, too, that it might be tougher on shorter hitters.
Which is rare.
Your thoughts on it.
Well, actually, I've got no dog in this fight because I've not been to Boston Golf Club yet. I've heard a lot about that hole, and I've heard a lot of pros and cons, which in general, as an architect, I think is a good thing, that they built something that's pretty controversial. You know, Pine Valley was that way in its day, too. Because, you know, as much as it's accepted as a great golf course now, Bernard Darwin thought it was way too severe, and he was a pretty good judge of golf courses overall. So, you know, to me, the tough part about designing short par fours is you have to make them playable for the average guy or there's, you know, or there's no point in really having them around. You know, I mean, they're the holes that are supposed to give the average guy a chance to have a hole or win a hole every once in a while. But the thing I haven't said, you know, I think there's a lot too much talk about, you know, driving greens on par fours as if most golfers ever really had a chance to do that. You know, to me, it's more important if the hole rewards placement of a tee shot when you can't drive the green. So, you know, if driving it to one side of the fairway gives you a straight-in approach to that green and driving it safely to the middle or the other side leaves you a much more difficult approach, then I'd say it's a good hole whether you can drive it or not.
And, Jay, looping back to the original question, you know, I'm sure you have played Rustic Canyon, but, I mean, there's a course that's tucked away in its own isolated valley, and I think it's got three great short par fours where there's all kinds of rooms and options, and the golfer's encouraged, you know, to make bold plays. But there's a reward at the end of it for pulling it off.
Again, a Gil Hatch course, one also very reminiscent of a course that's now NLE, also designed by Gil, which is Tallgrass down on Long Island, which had three wonderful short par fours. You know, Gil's very good at doing that. It's kind of a shame that New York lost Tallgrass. It was inexpensive, it was public, and you could get on it. And, you know, that's the kind of place you needed more of in New York City, not, you know, $200 golf courses, you know, that are that expensive every single day. Before we go to break, very quickly, each of you pick a couple of courses that were in the first version of the guide that have now jumped up significantly.
Ooh, Rand, you try that one because I have a hard time changing my mind.
Oh, well, the easiest one in the world for me is Moraine. I saw that in 1986, and in my equivalent to the Doak scale, I had it as a 4, and now I have it as an 8 in a World Top 100. I mean, you can't – that's just an astronomical rise. I keep a running tally of my favorite 500 courses, and a course has never jumped up the same number. I mean, it's 300 and some spots as Moraine, and that's the aforementioned Keith Foster at work. So that certainly stands out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'd just say from my perspective, it would be almost impossible for a course to change that much in my estimation just through restoration, because I'm probably going to think it was a better course in the original version, thinking that all they need to do is clear out some trees and they're going to make it better. And given it a great restoration will help one or two points on my scale for me, but I don't think I've seen a course where it helped more than that yet.
It's funny you should mention Moraine. I'm going to see Moraine next May when I'm going out to Cincinnati to run in the Flying Pig Marathon. But I'm also going to bring my clubs and play Camargo and Moraine and Culver Academy. Yeah, you heard that right. The Flying Pig Marathon. You get a flying pig for a medal, which is almost as good as a medal that you get at the Sleepy Hollow Marathon. Okay, it's the horseman rearing back on two legs, no head, oh no, but he's got the pumpkin in his hand and the pumpkin is in flames. So, yeah, great place to run a marathon.
If you play three better courses on any trip next year, I'll be impressed, because those are three great golf courses.
I'm hoping to, but I'm also looking forward to, especially with Pete Dye's recommendation on Camargo. Now, I recently ran about Culver. I'm going to get a chance to write about it for the American Golf Course Superintendents Association of America. I'm going to get a chance to write about Culver. And you called it perhaps the best nine-hole course in North America. How many spots did that have to jump? Because when you first saw it in 2006, it was a much lighter shade of itself.
Well, when Ted Sturgill and I saw it 10 years ago, there was no sand in the bunkers, and the greens were, I'm guessing, 40% smaller. But to Tom's point earlier, you could see the bones. You could see where all the bunkers were. You could see how huge the green pads were. You could see how the course would have played. And unlike a lot of people, I probably gave the course a six, even in that state, or a five, just because it was just a special design. And then they've, fully restored it, and they have a dedicated greenkeeper now who's doing a tremendous job. And I don't know if you know much about Culver Academy, but it's just, it is as good as it gets for training young men and young women. And it was an anomaly that the golf course was in such sad repair when everything else on the campus is pristine. So it's a great story, and of course Alice and Pete Dye used to summer there along that lake, which I cannot. Yeah, I'm afraid to pronounce the lake.
It's very pronounceable. It's easier than Lake Kadisha.
Right.
I was talking with Jim Henderson, who's the Emeritus Board of Trustees of Culver Academies, and he said something very interesting. He credits you with the resurgence of the golf course with just some very wise, well-measured, but well-chosen words, which, of criticism, some of which were, if they can't get excited about the golf course, how can we? And as Jim put it, I know you would never quite say it like this, but Jim basically said that he felt that you said that Culver owed it to the golf world to do a better job in getting this golf course into shape. I know you would never say it like that, but that was the impression Jim got. And he was grateful for that because he had no idea how good the pedigree of his golf course was.
Well, Jim is great at deflecting credit, but he is the man who absolutely drove everything there and deserves all the credit in the world.
And I'd just like to throw in on that, you know, one of the reasons it's such an underrated golf course is because it was built by Bill Langford, who's a really underrated architect. You know, he doesn't have courses in the top 100, primarily because some of his best work is pretty under-maintained. So, you know, there's no designer label benefit for the people that go around doing rankings. If the same golf course was built by Donald Ross, it would be considered more special. And that's the kind of thing you try to cut through in this book.
Well, it's funny because that was the very next question I was going to ask you, Tom, was to sum up Langford and Moreau, Theodore Moreau, his partner, for us. And I really think that a book like The Confidential Guide and a website like Golf Club Atlas have been absolutely integral in at least raising awareness about these guys, that they're not just old dead guys and they're not just some architect, that they were true disciples of McDonald, Rainer, and Banks, and are a strong and sturdy branch of golf course architecture that comes directly from the triumvirate, what I call the bloodline, you know, that were the fathers of TCA in America. So,
okay,
with
tell
that,
me
we're going to
you have read about Devereaux Emmett and Langford and Moreau, other than The Confidential Guide and Golf Club Atlas.
Well, I like writing about them. I love writing about Devereaux Emmett. I love writing about Langford and Moreau. I wrote a long piece on Lawsonia for the Magpie, the book out of Australia, the series Golf Course Architecture, volumes four and volume six. Paul Daly, thank you. That was the name that I was struggling for. He does an excellent job about it.
In terms of the major golf magazines, you know, it's not very sexy to write about a Langford and Moreau nine-hole course in Indiana.
You're right about that. Part of it is because we are still teaching everyone about the golden age of golf course architecture, you know, while we continue to build the second golden age of golf course architecture, and part because we still have, you know, too many looky-loos either on panels or, you know, that watch television and think that what they see on TV is what's good for golf. But we're moving well in the right direction, don't you think?
Oh, my goodness. How most people view architecture today, if you look at what were the favored architects in the 90s compared to today, it's unbelievable the sea change that has occurred in a mere 20 years.
Tom, your thoughts?
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Although, you know, I still think, going back to The Confidential Guide, too much attention is paid to who the architect's name is, even if it's me, you know, even if it's Jack Nicklaus. You know, in the end, we're trying to separate the best golf courses from each other. And, you know, what the book shows is that there's a lot of architects who have done some great work. And at the same time, a lot of great architects have done some not that inspired work here and there, too. And you want to understand the difference. You know, the problem is everybody just follows the designer label. And the controversial part of The Confidential Guide is that not all Jack Nicklaus or Tom Fazio golf courses are of equal quality. And that's not something they would like the public to know about.
I'm sorry, Flama, you're listening. Go ahead, Rand.
I'm sorry, one of the things, instead of these architect houses that build 100, 200, 300 courses, the biggest names now might finish their career building 30, 40, 50 courses, which is what Flynn did, Rainer did, on and on. And so, you know, to me, it's very much like craft beer. The Michelobes and the Budweisers, while they serve a role, they're far less interesting to mull over than some of the craft beers in Tom's home state, for instance.
You just made me have a good laugh about that, thinking about that golf hole that was shaped like a shark's mouth. being one of the crazier, perhaps being one of the crazier meads, or maybe a pumpkin ale. who designed that again? Who was the nut job that we all like at design the shark's teeth? The little fish green? You know what I'm talking about.
You must be talking about Desmond Muirhead.
Thank you, Desmond Muirhead. Yeah, okay.
Gotta be.
Well, we're going to get to two more. We're going to get back to two more trivia questions right after the break. We're going to come back. Ram and Tom are each going to have a chance to wear a bottle of hot sauce and a t-shirt that says I'm a hottie. And then we're going to talk a little bit of football, because I'm going to do the football picks. And Ram and Tom are going to tell us also, when we do the football picks, what's their favorite golf course, public and private, in the city where the game is being held. I'm Jay Plummer. You're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
That bump music means we're going to have to take a short break. Don't go away. We'll be back at the second half of the show in just a minute.
This is your main man, DJ Q, and you're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network.